Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show.
Well, welcome to History 605. Today on the show, we're going to cover the territorial governors. And with me back again is Braden. Braden, thanks for joining me on History 605.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
A little administrative side note here. We've been off the air for a while. Our production schedule was interrupted by all of the national and state goings-on for America's 250th birthday. And so we kind of set aside the production schedule for History 605 in order to attend to a lot of those things. So we appreciate your listening patience as we took a bit of a moratorium here for about a month. And we hope now to get back on schedule. And we thought we would do so with something that we've been kicking around for a while, is to do a show on the territorial governors. Braden and I have dug into the archives and the older publications, as well as the newer publications, that kind of think about these 10 very key individuals who governed Dakota Territory from its inception in 1861 all the way to statehood in November of 1889, a good hunk of time and a colorful cast of characters to discuss. Well, we hope to get through 4, 5, 6 of them, maybe 5 is where we'll land today. We'll see. But Braden, thanks for helping out talking about these very key people.
Yeah, you used the phrase colorful characters, and I can't think of a better way of describing these guys. But yeah, they're all very important, and it'll be interesting. We should start digging in.
But before we do, I think it's important to kind of set the scene on what's going on in the nation. When the first governor takes office in May of 1861, there could not be a worse time to become a territory. In the spring of 1861, when, you know, things are, the national effort is devoted elsewhere as the Civil War is beginning. In April of 1861, shots are fired on Fort Sumter by the forces erstwhile and what become the Confederate forces, Fort Sumter in South Carolina, and the war is on. And so setting up a territory government, which is the purview of the federal government, Congress and the president have duties in all of this, in marshaling the wherewithal and the resources and the people to go run a territory. This is a sideline to a sideline to a sideline of all the things that President Lincoln's got to worry about. And so the war that goes on and rages until 1865 really closes down a lot of the immigration that would have happened, as well as some other things, but we'll get into that. But certainly at the national level, the Civil War is kicked off and is raging as the territory begins. President Lincoln appoints a gentleman to do this. And before we name him, Braden, what are the duties of a territorial governor?
So yeah, there's a couple of them. But, you know, first and foremost, you're the executive power in the territory, right? So mm-hmm. You are speaking as the voice of the federal government. So you handle all the executive powers, you live within the territory, you're holding office for 4 years during that time, you are the commander in chief of the militia of the territory, so should something happen, your role is to get the boys together and go out and deal with it. Yeah. They're also the superintendent of Indian affairs, so dealing with the tribes and that relationship is the role of the governor of the territory. They need to approve all of the laws of the legislature before they end up taking effect. You have commissions and territorial offices that you're appointing. You're executing all the laws of the territory, right, and federal laws. So it's quite a big job, and you need someone that you can trust when you appoint someone as governor there.
You also, the governor will appoint the justices that act as federal court officials.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be one judge, it might be several judges, depending on the size and scope of the territory.
Right. I mean, drawing up counties for the territories, all of this is establishing a legislature. I mean, this is all the role in, under the purview of the governor.
Right. If you think about it, the territorial governors will set up all of the institutions of the state or of the territory. Mm-hmm. What schools are there going to be? Are there going to be courts, prisons, all of the justice system, from the prisons and the judges to the marshals? The U.S. Marshals, you have to coordinate with them, and that coordination can be as fraught or as frosty as human beings might make it, right? So, yeah, your point about the president trusting the governor is key, which might lead us into a good introduction about how the first territorial governor gets appointed. And that is because he's a trusted friend, or at least acquaintance, of the president, Abraham Lincoln. And the first territorial governor is William Jayne, a neighbor. Is that right? I mean, he's a gentleman from Springfield, Illinois, who knows Lincoln. How does William Jayne get the job?
Jayne was a neighbor of Lincoln. But then he also has connections within Congress at the time. I believe he's the brother-in-law of one of the representatives. And so he's got these different Republican connections, and Lincoln is obviously executing the Civil War at this time. So, well, I know Jayne, he can go and handle it.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of how the appointment ends up working out. And it's passed almost immediately. I mean, the president nominates him and Congress approves it. The Organization Act for the Dakota Territory happens March 2nd of 1861. And Jayne's in office not much long after that.
It's worth noting, too, that the Republican Party as an institution of itself, this is only its second presidential election. It was kind of birthed in Wisconsin in the mid-1850s in response to a lot of the politics of the day, slavery certainly being one, national expansion being another. And the former Whig Party, W-H-I-G, political party is dissolved, and a lot of the former Whigs are coming into the Republican Party. And it's kind of an amalgam of those Whigs, Free Soilers, of which Lincoln would count himself one, which is a lot of the former followers of Henry Clay. And then there's a kind of a commercial interest or business interested folks in the Republican Party, all seeking to save the Union primarily. And then there's also maybe 20 to 30%, depending on which time frame or what you look at, abolitionists join the Republican Party or are part of its beginning. And so the Republican Party in the 1850s and 1860s is really this kind of amalgamation of abolitionists, commercial and business interests, folks who want to save the Union at all costs. And then the fourth interest would be the Free Soilers. Those are largely people who felt that, as Lincoln said, Lincoln was very much a Free Soiler, and he's quoting the Bible when he says this, "You will live by the sweat of your own brow," which is kind of a moral code that slavery is wrong, you're to live by your own labors, and then also that the land that you live on should be something that you then improve. This sets up the Homestead Act, which is also kind of another. It's a major domestic issue that the Republicans pass in 1861, 1862, and then the first homesteader in South Dakota happens in January 1st, I think, of 1863 in Yankton. And that is just the drip, drip, drip beginning of what will become an avalanche by the late 1870s and into 1880s, the Homestead Act hitting this Dakota Territory pretty auspiciously.
Well, and like you say, there's just not the infrastructure set up yet to handle these large swaths of immigration. And the Civil War has started, so immigration is getting tamped down in that way. So it'll be a while before the Dakota Territory sees this boom. added along some other natural events and other disasters, yeah. And we won't see it until about the 1870s.
Yeah, most of the issues have to do with external to South Dakota. But another contextual thing is that Dakota Territory, the lines that it is defined by are shifting. In 1861, the territory encompasses all of present-day North and South Dakota, but it extends west to the Continental Divide, so clear to Montana, to western Montana. That's from 1861. Then in 1863, Idaho Territory is created, and that kind of sets that western boundary of Dakota Territory. Then the following year, Montana Territory is created, and that sets that western boundary for the northern part of Dakota Territory. So the North Dakota-Montana line is established, but Dakota Territory still includes Wyoming until 1868. And so when the governor, Jane, and the first three of them that come out here, they're dealing with North and South Dakota and a good hunk of what is today modern Wyoming. And so when you think about they're the Indian agents for that, they've got Dakota, the Lakota, the Arapaho, the Cheyenne, Blackfeet, and a series of tribes out west, that, as well as the Omaha, potentially Ponca. You know, there's a quite a moving target of tribes to deal with, as well as the internal politics of all the settlers that they're trying to encourage to come here.
So with all that background,
right,
you know, you'd hope that you're sending some of the most qualified people out to start to govern this territory.
And what is Jane's background then? William Jane, who becomes the first territorial governor.
Yeah, he's a personal physician. I mean, he's a doctor. He's a medical doctor, right? He's not some admin whiz who's going to be whipping people into shape or a martial leader. But I think that it's true of most of the early governors and most of the early politicians in the Dakota Territory. These are typically ambitious younger men who are looking to use the Dakota Territory as a stepping stone for different political appointments and to launch their political careers.
And a lot of them will try to wind up in Congress or in the Senate themselves. Mm-hmm. And they see the territorial governorship as kind of a way to just do what you just said, to enter into that elective politics option later on, perhaps in their state back home. In Jane's case, might be Illinois, or as the territory becomes a state, they're seen as maybe an automatic contender for that Senate seat or what have you. So,
and I don't want to take fully away from Jane. He was mayor of Springfield he was elected several times there. He was a state senator. He was a commissioner to help build the state capitol. So it's not like he's just this complete rookie stepping in over his head. Yeah, this is uncharted territory for him.
You think of it as kind of it would be potentially easy to think of it as kind of an entrepreneurial startup kind of thing. I mean, you need to make something out of nothing, more or less. And the people that you attract become the wherewithal of what you can do. And so one of the first thing a governor needs to do is conduct a census. And what's the count that Governor Jane has to work with in this census?
Yeah, so the census was taken from the 1860 Dakota Territory census. Uh-huh. And you're looking at about 2,400-odd settlers. Most of these are single men who are... Yep. Farming's maybe not the right word, but they're making a living out in the territories, you know, whether it be agriculture, it could be through trade, it could be through land speculation, but you've got about 2,400
and those
settlers.
Non-Indian settlers.
Right.
The wherewithal of that, and where does he land?
The capital of
Dakota Territory, the sprawling Dakota Territory, goes all the way to the Continental Divide.
Well, and I was going to say, Ben, it seems like we're always doing one of these capital battles.
Yeah.
Jane initially lands, he comes up through Sioux City, and he lands on Yankton being the territorial capital. And that immediately sets off the locals, because there's a local element to this happening too. So as well as being the governor and dealing with the federal side and all those duties, he has to be fairly in tune with the local populace. Yeah, there are three different communities who are vying for the capital at this time. It's Bonhom, it's Vermilion, and it's Yankton. And so Yankton gets chosen partially, depending on the source that you read, because of J.B.S. Todd, who is Mary Todd Lincoln's cousin. He's a prominent politician out in the Dakota Territories at this time. And he's one of the Yankton boys. And so...
Yeah. So he was a cousin to the First Lady of the United States. He had been in Congress prior to this, J.B.S. Todd had. He'd been to West Point, an accomplished man, and he kind of moved across the river when he's after the Treaty of 1858 with the Yankton tribe, what is today the Yankton Sioux tribe. They sign a treaty with the United States government in 1858 for selling the rights to their land, which goes from kind of east and north of the Missouri River, all the way up to a line around Redfield or so, kind of Coddington County to Redfield, that line. And that 1.5 million, by the way, would never get fully paid to the tribe, and it winds up in court until the 1950s, I think. That's the land that is primarily the settlement zone. And so Yankton makes sense for that if the entry is through the rivers, right? There's no railroads yet. There's no roads, or very few. And so the rivers are the kind of the way you would approach it. And Jane probably comes in, gets off the train in Sioux City between horse and riverboat, makes his way to Yankton. He stops off in Vermilion, doesn't he? And the people there lobby hard to get...
He's getting wooed by the Vermilionites, and they're trying to get him to settle there, because there are, and we probably don't have the time to get into all the nitty gritty, but there are several different prominent settlers who are vying all the time to have their town or their interests furthered in this Dakota territory. The political corruption is interesting in this early territorial area.
And Jane resigns in March of 1863, I think.
Part of it is that we were talking about J.B.S. Todd. He is elected, you know, part of the setting up of this government is to have someone in the House of Representatives.
That's right.
Who's in Washington, who gets to speak on behalf of the territory. You know, they don't get an official vote in Congress, but on the committees, they get to have a say. And J.B.S. Todd is elected to that position. 1862... They have to re-elect all those positions. I think it was just a temporary appointment or something of that nature. But an election is held. Elected delegate to Congress is the term.
Is the title, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, Jane is ready to, he's ready to get out of here.
I mean, yeah, that's right. I think he runs for that position.
He's running for the position, right? And he's told he's won it. So the election happens. They're missing votes from up in the North Dakota area.
Oh, yeah.
Which end up going directly to Todd. There's some ballot stuffing for Jane that happens.
Really?
Some soldiers from Sioux City on their day off find their way to South Dakota or to the Dakota Territory and have a vote. So, there's immediately some issues. But eventually they start to figure it out. J.B.S. Todd is reelected, but Jane had resigned under the assumption that he had won. So he's resigned his position thinking that he's going to be the congressional representative for the Dakota Territory.
And he goes to Washington and then he turns out he loses after all. And J.B.S. Todd is reelected as delegate.
Yeah, it's a strange election, because during this time too, 1862 is when the U.S. Dakota War is happening. That's having an effect on the election, getting people up from, you know, because again, Dakota Territory is far reaching at this point. Right. So you've got people voting all over the place, and having to bring them all the way down to Yankton to get the results in. I mean, it takes a bit of time. So some of those votes didn't reach when they were supposed to, but did that make them invalid? Who knows? The ballot stuffing is...
and that may be lost to history, what exactly happened there. But in any event, JBS Todd wins the election. And yeah, so Jane is done. He resigned prematurely, perhaps. But so now President Lincoln needs to name a new governor. In the Pryor Museum, we had this on display. The next fellow is Governor Newton Edmonds. Newton Edmonds' appointment letter is a note from President Lincoln saying, I guess we better appoint blank Edmonds to the role. He can't even remember his first name. Because again, he's a little busy with the Civil War going on. It's October of 1863.
October 1st of 1863. Yeah. The whole note is this. It's Honorable Secretary of the Interior, sir. I suppose that blank Edmonds better be appointed governor of Dakota. Get the name and send it. Get the name and send it with this to the secretary, A. Lincoln.
A. Lincoln, yeah. So
get his name and get him out there.
get him out there. We've dawdled around too much. And Newton Edmonds, he doesn't really know Mr. Blank Edmonds, fill in the blank with the first name of Newton. He doesn't really know him, but he's doing a political favor for a friend from Michigan who does. I think that's the chain of relationships.
Well, and Edmonds wasn't even Lincoln's first choice. I mean, Lincoln offers it up to a gentleman from Wisconsin, J.F. Potter, who declines. because, I mean, your options are, do you appoint, you know, Todd? Do you try and reappoint Jane? Do you find this neutral third ground, your third party doesn't want to accept the position. So, all right, I guess we're going with Edmonds.
I guess so. Of course, he wasn't going to appoint Todd because he's a Democrat.
Yeah.
He might be a cousin to his wife, but he's a Democrat. So that would be tough to do. I mean, I suppose you could do it, but yeah, that'd just be tough. So there'd be some blowback to appointing somebody from another party. So Newton Edmonds is the man, and off he goes to Yankton. And really, I mean, Edmonds is an interesting fellow. He winds up living the rest of his life in Dakota, in South Dakota, becomes a leading citizen of Yankton, involved in many public and commercial interests in Dakota Territory and in South Dakota for the rest of his life. So in many ways, he's a quality appointment.
I don't want to say strangely quality, but I mean, he is.
We say uniquely qualified.
And it's interesting too, Howard Lamar in his book Dakota Territory, he mentions that a lot of the gentlemen who are playing in the Dakota Territory politics come from this northeastern background. They're mostly Protestant, if not all Protestant, but importantly, they're all American. You don't see the immigrants who have settled in the area or immigrants coming in, partially because we talked about the war. But you don't see immigrants take a large step in the politics. And part of that is because once you're William Jane, you're Newton Edmonds, you're Andrew Falk get into power, they're using these political appointments to help get these regional blocks to help further their political or goals out in the territory. And so there's a specific cadre of people that you see who are actively paving the way in the politics of the Dakota Territory at this time.
Right.
A lot of Eastern appointments.
Now, Edmonds, he's got quite a challenge. So the fall of 1863, and he serves until August of 1866. So that is some interesting times. You mentioned the Dakota War. That will continue. Many people, obviously, you might recall, and listeners of this program may be aware of the mass execution that occurs in December of 1862 in Mankato, Minnesota. And many people think that that's kind of the end of the Dakota War, but that's not the case. I've read comments of Newton Edmunds when he's governor. He's also, as you said, the Indian agent. And so he's negotiating with tribes. He's trying to conduct an end to the war. The army sends more troops into Dakota Territory. The only path is up and down the Missouri River. And General Sully, who's ultimately, he's kind of the senior general prosecuting the war against the Dakota and Lakota in the territory. Edmunds and Sully don't really see eye to eye on a lot of these things. And he's got to communicate with him, with General Sully, and essentially prosecute the war. He's always working to bring the war to a conclusion so that Dakota Territory seems to be a hospitable place for people to come. And this is kind of alongside the Civil War, which is hampering immigration, as we already said. So, but he wants that when the Civil War is over, he's trying to make sure that the Dakota War is over. And that's not really concluded until late in 1865 as well. This is one part and parcel of his duties, is to get this situation with the Dakota kind of over with one way or another. And in addition to, what's often known as Red Cloud's War kicks off in 1866. And that's conducted in Western South Dakota, Wyoming, parts of Nebraska. This impacts him as well, because Dakota Territory goes all the way to what is today modern day Wyoming when Edmunds is the governor. So just a large span of control, difficult issues to deal with, while he's also trying to set up a legislature, a court system, appoint people to justice of the peace, postmasters, all this kind of stuff.
One of the things that Edmunds is kind of known for is collecting taxes. I mean, Jane really didn't do much tax collection in 1864 and 1865. Edmunds is writing and he's really being insistent that we have to start doing taxes. He says, to perfect and put in running order our internal machinery, even though to do so we might have to submit to be lightly taxed. The first taxes that are collected, it was only about $500 worth.
Okay.
In the entire Dakota Territory. And most of that is the crew that are in Yankton. But there's just not a system for the government to really run without getting money directly from Washington.
Right. So what is he taxing? Is it like a sales tax or a real estate tax?
It wasn't exactly clear, just passing the hat around, right? Yeah. Yeah, I couldn't find the specifics, but he's trying to get these different taxes going to do something. But it's also because he's looking at schools. School is not a thing in the Dakota Territory, so he's trying to set that up. School law gets passed in 1864. He has James S. Foster become the first superintendent of public instruction in August. And this is, you know, all this is important too, because one of Jane's promises to Vermilion and Bonhomme was that Vermilion would get a public university, or they would get a land university.
The beginnings of what becomes USD.
Exactly. Bonhomme is promised a penitentiary, and that's what's supposed to placate them.
They'll get the territorial penitentiary.
Right.
Well, in those communities, so it's kind of on a branch, on a communication line or road, and what they're trying to become a railroad out of Sioux City to Vermilion, Yankton, Bonham, Springfield. These set of four or five communities, largely along the river, but then also aspire to be linked by railroad to Sioux City, because once you get to Sioux City, then you're kind of in the national transportation network. So there's aspirations there too, to bring a railroad to the state capital, wherever, or the territorial capital, wherever that might be.
I found the tax here. It was in January of 1866, a general revenue law was enacted. Little property, however, was listed for taxation. So that's why they only end up netting about $500.
Okay. So it is a sense of real estate tax.
Yeah.
Based on your property you own. Yeah, and there's probably less than 10,000 people and less than 5,000 people who own taxable real estate. Well, okay, though, so he's his appointment is up in 1866. At the national level, it's worth kind of stepping back to the, what's going on now in the late summer, fall of 1866. The Civil War is over. Lincoln is assassinated, of course. Andrew Johnson becomes president. Andrew Johnson is from a different wing of the Republican Party. In fact, he was a Democrat. Such a vastly different wing of the Republican Party that he's not in the Republican Party at all. In fact, when he runs in 1864 on the Lincoln ticket, they both call themselves Unionists. And Andrew Johnson is from Tennessee, is a pro-Union Democrat. So his membership in the Republican Party spinning out of the war is really tenuous. In fact, he gets impeached for a number of reasons. He's a particularly, well, let's just say his relationship with Congress is pretty poor. He tries to fire his Secretary of War. Congress says, no, you can't. The Secretary of War says, no, you can't. There's a huge fight, goes to a lawsuit, and then over another matter regarding the first civil rights bill by the wing of the Republican Party, often called radical Republicans, Johnson vetoes the civil rights bill. And that's ostensibly what they impeach him for. That's really probably what they impeach him for, the Congress, which wants to get the civil rights bill passed. And in all of that, out pops Andrew Jackson Faulk. It's important that Andrew Jackson, right, a Union Democrat, inspired evidently Mr. Faulk's parents to name him that, he comes out to be, and he's appointed by Andrew Johnson then to be the territorial governor of Dakota Territory.
And Faulk had actually been out in the Dakota Territory prior to his appointment.
Yeah.
He was the aide-de-camp for General Cook when he came out during the Dakota War, before the change with General Sully and how that all shook out. But Faulk is not new to the territory.
No. He's a resident of Bonham, buying up lots of land and around Springfield and Bonham and Yankton. He owns land. He's an Indian agent. He's selling equipment and supplies to the Indian tribes. He's facilitating that, and he's working with other people around the Yankton, kind of the political orbit and the business orbit in Yankton, to do all these. So yeah, you're right. He's not a stranger to Dakota Territory. He's a resident of Dakota Territory. And so in that sense, it's good.
Yeah. In that sense, it is good. But part of that is also that I think Faulk has some ideas and some schemes and machinations on ways that he can get rich. And so he's actually part of one of our earliest railroad schemes, the organization of the Dakota Northwestern Railroad and it trying to be linked. There's a crew of a lot of the territorial congressmen, two members of the council. So the territorial government, when it was set up, it had the House and then the council, which would be the Senate eventually, Faulk. But all these guys they're joining these boards for incorporation while also governing and giving out contracts. It's a mess. It's a darn mess.
His big supporter in Dakota Territory is Burley, a man whose street graces one of the Yankton's town streets to this day. They both are clerking and working with the Indian trades and managing the trading post at the Yankton Agency and kind of part of all of that. It's one of the few, frankly, ways to make a living, these government contracts in the territory. And so he's kind of a part of the Burley faction of the territorial Republicans as their candidate for governor. Burley then, pretty good guy to know because he becomes the delegate for the Dakota Territory and replacing J.P.S. Todd that we talked about.
And kind of talking, we can touch on Faulk's relationship with the different tribes. I think it's interesting. Falk was convinced that the land should be opened up for white settlement. And he was very in favor of pushing settlement, as I think all these governors were, because it leads to more opportunities for themselves, but also kind of helps pad your resume when you have a booming territory that everyone wants to come on into. But he also ends up doing a lot to secure relief for Native Americans as well, especially when there's some grasshopper droughts that are devastating the territory during his tenure as governor. So he's got this interesting mixed relationship with the tribes, I suppose is to be expected as the superintendent for Indian Affairs and the governor of the Dakota Territory. He wears kind of two hats that sometimes clash.
Yeah, it is kind of, that's a good point. If you're going to work to manage Indian affairs, then part of that is implied in that task is seeing to their welfare to the extent that you can. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, if you're going to promote the territory and you want white settlement to come in, that impedes, it could impede, and in many cases did impede, the welfare of the tribal members. So that can often come into conflict. And he's kind of, you see that he's on both sides of that issue, trying to manage that.
Well, and he's coming in at a time when they just wrapped up the Dakota War. So tensions are still heightened, you know.
Yes.
You've got to have a real diplomatic hand when you're doing this. So, no, I was just going to say it's interesting to see how he's walking that line.
As governor, it did seem that he's advertising the territory in as much as he can, particularly the Black Hills region in particular. And he works to have that area excluded from the Indian Reserve. Now, at the federal level, the commission that's charged with ending what's called Red Cloud's War is working to sign a deal, and they wind up ultimately creating a huge reserve in all of the western part of what is today South Dakota, west of the Missouri to the Wyoming line. This is not something that he's for. And so while he's working, and this is probably the biggest thing that sets him up, is, you know, trying to promote certain aspects of Indian welfare, which can be done by various ways of enforcing the current treaties, keeping the supplies moving to the reservations and so forth in accordance with previous treaty agreements and other promises made, but then also working to open up the Black Hills to settlement and to mining is, you know, not conducive to what Red Cloud wants. That's certainly the case.
So Falk, during all of this, he's starting to clash more and more with the local politics. And so in the election of 1868, Burley breaks with both factions in the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Because they're having their own split, and runs for re-election as a, quote, people's candidate. The anti-Burley radical Republicans successfully carried the territory for Grant and quickly drew up a full slate of nominees for the federal appointments in Dakota. So Burbank was not a territorial nominee, owed his position. Six other persons nominated by party leaders of the territory receive appointments. Falk's starting to run into some issues here. He starts to get into it with people like Brookings, W.W. Brookings, and even the legislature memorialize Congress asking for the appointment of W.W. Brookings as governor of the territory. There's votes in the House that he's clashing with them and the council, and it ends up being quite a mess. quite a mess.
Burbank, you mentioned him as probably a good lead into his becoming governor. He's a man from Indiana, and as Falk's political star is waning and the Johnson administration is out the door, Ulysses Grant is elected president in 1868, takes office in March of 69, and then he appoints Burbank to take the office of Dakota Territory. Burbank is kind of he's come up through Indiana politics as a friend of the various people that are kind of friends with the president. So he doesn't know Grant particularly well. He had served in the Civil War. He'd been an Indian agent in Iowa and Missouri prior to this. And he had served in Indiana units during the Civil War. People must put his name up in front of President Grant for him to be the territorial governor. And he's appointed. He arrives in early stages of what's been called a kind of a prosperous period of territorial history. Comes into Yankton, steamboats drop him off, and it's a part of this kind of thriving merchandise trade. There's people coming in. Burbank is, maybe he kind of inherits some of the hard work that his predecessors had done.
And as you mentioned, you know, about the kind of thriving times, in the 1870 census that's taken for the Dakota Territory, they're seeing about 14,000 non-Indian inhabitants that are now being counted.
Yeah.
And most of them are arriving in 1867. You know, so in about a 3-year span, you're going from about 2,500, you know, a little waxing and waning here and there, up to 14,000. So you're starting to see this, the boom of the population. Also, as you mentioned, because it is profitable time during the, for the Dakota Territory, people aren't happy that Burbank gets appointed.
Right.
He's unpopular right from the get-go.
Right from the get-go. Through no fault of his own. In the words of a Yankton newspaper editor, many, quote, who had worked strenuously and spent their own money for the success of the straight Republican ticket, were grievously disappointed to see all the good plums go to outsiders. In fact, they were indignant. Here was the most inevitable clash between local party leaders and cohorts on the national scene who regarded territorial jobs as federal patronage. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they can't, they're the ones working and slaving through to grow all these institutions, grow their businesses, build homes, build schools, and all this stuff. And then this guy from Indiana shows up.
Right, immediately. But he shows up, but not really for long. Burbank doesn't really like to hang out in the territory for too long.
No, I mean, he's taking, not a big fan.
He's taking leaves of absence left and right.
Yeah.
So much so that the Attorney General of Dakota, James Hand, writes a letter to Hamilton Fish, the Secretary of State, that says the present governor has been in Washington or Indianapolis for about 3/4 of the time since his appointment, which was in April of 1869. And for the last 6 months, the Secretary G.A. Batchelder has been away nearly all of the time. They do not seem to have any interest in
Common with the people of Dakota.
In common, so, there you go. And salary. only give attention to the duty of drawing their salary.
You know, it's interesting. They're appointed by the president, but they work for the Secretary of State. We wouldn't realize Secretary of State is responsible for foreign affairs of the United States. But at this time, when there's territories, the territorial governors reported to the Secretary of State. And so, yeah, Hamilton Fish, who's in D.C., or one of the leading families in the Boston area at the time. And so that's why he's writing to him, just to make sure that people understand, why would he be writing to the guy in charge of foreign affairs? Well, he is, because he's also in charge of territorial affairs.
Burbank is having, he doesn't necessarily show up in politics a lot, but he does get out here for some of the important stuff, like the convening of the first biannual session of the territorial legislature, and also for some of the more important decisions, you know, looking at selecting the penitentiary at Fort Madison. He has Dakota prisoners sent there, not Dakota the tribe, but Dakota Territory prisoners sent down there to Fort Madison. He's also working to securing railroads and get more rail lines into Dakota Territory.
That leads to one of the more interesting crimes in the history of Dakota Territory. The murder of the acting governor, McCook.
Yeah.
And we've got a whole podcast on that. Folks can dial back down the menu option and see conversation we had about the trials of Wintermute, who Burbank was out of town, out of the territory. The affairs of the governor's run by the secretary. In this case, it was General McCook. And they get into a shouting match over a number of things, largely spawned out of this argument about the railroads and bond sales and loans and banking structures and so forth that was going to be bringing in the railroads to Yankton.
People found that the circumstances surrounding the bond sales is interesting. It's being led by ex-Governor Edmonds. They're petitioning the territorial secretary, who's acting in Burbank's absence, to convene a special session. He complies. The legislature meets to authorize counties to issue bonds to aid in the construction of the railroads. They don't really know the legality of this special session. So yeah. Batch Elder he's wiring, telegramming the U.S. Attorney General, A.T. Ackerman, trying to figure out, is this authorized or not? And in a reply, Ackerman, a telegram was soon received from Ackerman to the effect that the session was, quote, authorized. The legislature, therefore, they immediately sign it and give it to the acting governor, who signs it. The next day, the attorney general's full telegram arrives at the station saying that the special assembly was unauthorized.
Oops.
Yeah, apparently the Western Union had an issue with the telegrams, or something happens, but people smell fish. They don't think that this was all in the up and up, and so they appeal to Congress to clear up the results. And Congress decides that the session was illegal, but the bond issue law is valid.
Yeah.
And so they still require the railroad company to issue certificates of stock to Yankton County for the full amount of the bonds. And that's where you kind of get the two groups coming together and clashing, and they're trying to settle it down. And they have this meeting in Yankton, and that's where General McCook is shot.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But all of this is because Burbank isn't there.
Isn't there, right.
He's off doing something else, and one of his representatives has to make a call in his stead.
Right. William Beadle, who's the territorial surveyor at the time, talks about this in his autobiography. He says he's up near Bismarck, and he buys a copy of the Bismarck Tribune, and he sees a blazing headlines that Jay Cook had failed, meaning that massive treasury scandal at the federal level. Jay Cook had failed, and the secretary, Ed S. McCook, had been mortally wounded by a pistol shot from Wintermute, a Yankton banker. Here was the panic of 1873, later attributed as the crime of 73, as the gold standard was called, that affected us all so seriously, and the homicide that has influenced hundreds of men ever since. The proceedings against Wintermute went on. He was promptly arrested and guarded, indicted for manslaughter that October term, released on heavy bail, indictment quashed in January of 1874, held in custody, indicted for murder in April, tried in May, and after 3 weeks of contest, convicted of manslaughter, which was reversed on appeal to the Supreme Court. A change in venue was then taken to Clay County, whereupon the jury of that community, he was acquitted. The excitement in Yankton and the strong feelings previously existing between opposing factions there, which was greatly intensified by this event, caused the case to be reported everywhere. So these prominent men, such as General McCook, led to newspaper discussions in remote cities. Thus it came about that the result of the final trial was criticized and reflections were cast upon South Dakota. The entire affair was most deplorable. Yet I have never heard any facts alleged or any serious and unbiased opinion expressed that reflected upon the integrity of the court or of the Clay County jury before and by whom acquittal was made. So this is General Beadle lamenting later in life about how, again, when trying to attract people to come live in Dakota Territory, and you think all this, you know, murder and mayhem is going on, it makes this area not very inviting at all.
Right. And the McCook shooting has further implications, too. Mm-hmm. So Burbank is using his influence as the territorial governor to get the United States Department of the Interior to appoint McCook's father-in-law, Oscar Whitney, as the new territorial secretary. And so during another one of Burbank's absences, the Secretary Whitney, acting as governor, uses his power to start to reassign territorial judges and ends up transferring the wrong judge, Judge Barnes, to a different district. This was the final straw for a lot of the folks in Dakota Territory.
Right.
And so upon the request of his brother-in-law, Burbank's brother-in-law, he resigns in December of 1873.
Yeah. Well, resigning is better than getting shot, I guess.
I would suppose so.
There's enough to talk about for at least two shows. So this will be part one of what we call the Territorial Governors episodes. We'll do a part two, maybe a part three, depending on how things go. But I think you'll see that what's really struggling here is to create institutions within which a territory where there's very little resources, the government, the federal government, is supremely distracted by an existential crisis of the American Civil War and then Reconstruction afterwards, and doing right by the native tribes has all kinds of definitions of what right looks like. And there'll be lots of discussion about that. And so these gentlemen are being put in a position of a lot of...
Well, all the pressures, I mean, you have the Native Americans.
Yep.
And how do you deal with them? You have business interest who's starting to enter the territory.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you compete with them? How do you try and draw them in,
right,
while still, you know, maintaining that? You have a local influence that's, mm-hmm, working on you. And then you have the federal influence. You're
right.
Not necessarily from the territory. And how does that affect you?
Right.
Are you just using this as a stepping stone? Or it's interesting to see the way that,
yeah,
these different forces are pushing and pulling on this position of territorial governor.
And setting up a justice system, setting up a school system.
Oh, yeah.
Setting up all the competing entities that you have to master and to marshal. Even the finest of human beings, of which a couple of the governors that we'll talk in the next episode may be in the running for this definition of finest human beings. Even among these finest human beings, it would be difficult to master this challenge.
Yeah, it seems like more than a one-person job in my mind. I don't know.
Right, right. We'll end there with Governor Burbank, and we'll kick off with John L. Pennington, who's an interesting fellow, another grant appointee, with the next episode. Thanks, Braden.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats or the Republicans or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that...
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.